Okay, and we're back here at the AIR studio, and joining me on the phone is Chief Roger Longtoe Sheehan. Thank you so much for joining us. Hello.
Thanks for having me on. Corey to Deb and everybody else, and to Mark and Jess.
Hey, how
just
are
you? You guys on, and I was listening and realized you guys were talking.
Yeah. We didn't think you'd stay on the phone line.
You guys are almost like Laurel and Hardy, man, on the radio.
Roger, thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell our listeners where you're from?
Well, El New is basically based out of southern Vermont. The headquarters is my house, which is in Jamaica, Vermont. We have members, quite a few of us are down here in the Windham County area of Vermont, but we have members up in Jefferson, some up in the Highgate, Swanton area. And then we have people that are out of state, too. You know, we're spread out a little bit, but most of us are down here in Windham County.
Now, you were just visiting and had a little ceremony ritual at the petroglyphs there in Bellows Falls. You want to tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, we've been doing this for quite a few years. Every year, the guys go to Lake George, and generally we get back before the weekend, normally around October 19th, somewhere around there. When we get together, we'll generally have a social at my brother's place over in Westminster. And we'll get the whole tribe to show up, you know, or as many people that can show up. And we'll generally have a social on Saturday night and stuff. And then on Sunday morning, we go down there to do a little ceremony down at the Faces. Basically to show the kids where they are, talk about them a little bit. We'll do a little drumming, give some tobacco offerings. Used to tie the tobacco to the little trees and stuff. Basically, there were all these kind of sumac trees that used to hang out kind of off the cliff there. But the town has cut most of those away. So, you know, most folks will just drop tobacco down and stuff. Or sometimes we'll go down. This year the water was pretty high. It was kind of a dangerous, you know, thing to go down there. So we stood up on the cliff and on the bridge that's now closed, which is kind of a nice platform to look down on the Faces. Because that's what we just call them. We just call them the Faces.
The Faces.
Yeah.
There was a great article, thank you so much for sending me, that was in the Messenger, the weekly paper down your way.
Yep.
That was talking about the area and the site, the petroglyphs, and it's really a wonderful article. Did you put that on your website yet?
Have we? No, we haven't done that yet. No,
it's a really good one.
Robert Smith, who had written the article, he had interviewed me and my wife a couple of years ago about the artwork that we do, wampum belts and the other types of crafts and traditional things, you know, that we make. He gave me a call like maybe 3-4 weeks ago and said, hey, I want to get the Abenaki perspective on, you know, on the Faces and what's going on down there and stuff. And, you know, we sat down, well, I sat over the phone and talked to him for a while and basically explained kind of, you know, the importance of the place. It's kind of a neat place that you can actually go. And even though some of those carvings have probably been touched up back in the 20s and 30s by the Daughters of the American Revolution, they had a mason go out there and touch them up and stuff. But it's still kind of a neat place that you can go there and touch something that your ancestors did. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, nobody's really sure how old they are. We know they're way over a couple of hundred years old. Kind of a neat place. Besides the whole fact of that whole area being originally a burial ground, I'm kind of glad I don't live in Bellows Falls. I like go visit there, but I don't think I'd want to live there.
Yeah, I had no idea that they had unearthed so many skeletons there until I read that article.
Yeah.
That's big work. That's big work. Yeah. I also want to tell our listeners that you are also a singer, a storyteller, a historian, and a traditional native tattooist.
Yep.
And now, how did that come about? I want to know about the tattoo.
The tattooing started when I was a kid, about 13, 14 years old. Actually, the first two tattoos that are traditional tattoos I did to myself when I was 14 years old.
Oh.
And little by little, I've done more and more over the years and stuff.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the tattoos I have are all traditional tattoos that are on my body. They all have protective meanings behind them. Some of them are family tattoos representing, you know, myself and my family, but a lot of the ones are, besides decorative, they're also protective. The right side of my body represents the upper world, Sven Ki. The left side represents the underwater world or the underground world. Most of the men in the tribe, the younger men, well, I shouldn't say younger men because a lot of the guys are my age, have tattoos, traditional. Some of them have been done traditionally by me in the old way. Others have been done with, you know, in with modern machinery and stuff. And it's the same thing with myself. There's places where I just can't tattoo myself. So I've had to have somebody else do it. And, you know, it's a lot quicker when you do it with the modern machines.
In your research on the history of tattooing, I mean, was this something that you think was done by the people? What time period are we talking about?
Pre-contact. As Christianity started to take over, as many of the Abenaki people started becoming Catholic, you see it start decreasing. So by the 1800s, if they are having tattoos, they're probably hidden under their clothing. Because again, the people started wearing more and more clothing, started fitting into the European culture more so.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, by the time you get into like the 1850s and 60s, most of the Abenaki men are wearing pants. And, you know, in shirts, and, you know, the women are wearing dresses and stuff. So those tattoos, you wouldn't be able to see them. But previous to that, you know, all through when Champlain comes through, he talks about the natives in the Northeast tattooing their bodies, and in some cases very heavily. Again, protective, decoration.
Yeah.
It was a sign of a man, but also women had them, too.
Women had them, too?
Yes.
Were they more on the body, but how about the face?
You don't, as far as we can tell, not too many on the face. We don't see any on the face, thing, you know, on the wrists, the arms, the legs. Again, as clothing starts to, you know, become, they're wearing more and more European-style clothing, it's covering it up. So in the case of the women, a lot of times, again, who knows what was under their clothing.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, it's just like when you go up north to the Inuit people. The women are often, well, were heavily tattooed, but because they wear their parkas and their snow pants and stuff like that, you know, you don't see that in a private way. But yeah, tattooing was a very, very common thing here.
Well, what are you using for the inks? I'm just so curious about this. This is
there are many different woods and inner barks that are burnt. You take, it's basically charcoal. So you could literally take charcoal out of a fire, and you have to crush it very, very finely, and you mix it with water until it basically becomes Indian ink. When I do it, I use a cedar stick, because cedar is a sacred plant, sacred tree. And then what I'll do is I'll put in several needles, modern needles. But before that, they would have used fish bones, different types of bones, even hawthorns might have been used too. And basically you wrap the end of the needles together with some cord, a little very fine like thread. And what that does is it acts as an ink blotter to hold the ink, and at the same time, it stops the needles from going too deep. But you have to go through all seven layers of skin. You basically have to bleed, otherwise the tattoo won't stay.
Wow. Start
proceeding to prick the skin. The other way of doing it is that you traditionally would take a piece of flint, and to do straight linear-type tattoos, you would incise a line with a piece of flint, and then you would rub that mixture of charcoal and water into the cut. So that was another way of doing it. I've done a couple of those. I don't like doing them because I'm always worried that I'm going to cut too deep with the stone, and so I prefer doing the puncture method.
But you also do a lot of stone work, making traditional items.
Yep.
And I saw some pictures of your woodworking and knife making, and you're really very skillful in the arts. So when you do the living history, you would take your crafts and be demonstrating these different crafts that you do?
Yep. It depends on where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll be at a museum, and I'll be in just modern clothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll go or some sort of a historical site, and I'll sometimes sit down and make, you know, soapstone pipes, or you know, there's a million things to do. Could carve a war club, whatever. At other times, when I'm at a living history event, generally I sit at the event, and you know, we put out a blanket and sell things. Sometimes we're doing some singing, and when I say we, I literally mean we, the whole tribe, or many of the members of the tribe. Not everybody in the tribe is involved in living history, but probably close to 70 to 80% of the people are. One of the neat things about it is that over the years, it's allowed us to practice our culture and our traditions and our crafts. You know, some of the women do moose hair embroidery, porcupine quill work. Some of the men do that. Finger weaving. That's one of the neatest things I've seen, is that the generations of people, we've got from grandmothers down to little children who are finger weaving. And the older women passing it on to the younger women. It's kind of a neat thing. It's the same thing with the stonework and stuff like that. You know, my son sat around for years watching me do this stuff, and he does it now. And then, I'll, you know, sometimes we'll get one of the young guys. They'll be like, hey, I want to learn how to make a pipe, you know. So we go in the workshop, and we start cutting out some soapstone, and, you know, next thing you know, they come out, and they've got a soapstone pipe, and take them out in the woods and cut down a, well, don't cut down a tree, but, a, you know, an ash sapling or a branch, depending on the size of the pipe. Burn out the center with a coat hanger and dry it up, and they've got a pipe so that, you know, they can smoke it for personal stuff or for ceremony. We have people doing wampum belt work. Actually, one of our members right now, one of our elders, is actually making the wampum beads himself.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Wow.
Which is, you know, I mean, I've been doing, my wife has been doing wampum belts for years upon years, in mostly in glass, but the wampum beads have recently became available at a you know, a halfway decent price that you afford them. One of the things that I've had her working on is belts for the tribe. So one of the belts that she's done is a marriage belt, which is used when, you know, for a marriage ceremony. The other belt I'm hoping to get in the near future is a condolence belt. Because two of the things in a community's life that goes on all the time is people get married, people are born, people die.
Mm-hmm.
And so having those belts for those ceremonies and things like that. Yeah. And then knowing the songs that go along with some of these.
Yes. And of course, Jesse is also a master craftsman at basket weaving,
He's
of course.
A good basket maker.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I've seen you out there at the powwows pounding the ash, man.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. But
yep.
Little trade secret, Mitchell makes baskets too.
Does he?
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, you're gonna have to rope him into loaning you his hammer.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't want a lot of people to know that, Roger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why we said it on the radio.
So, yeah, so you got Jesse spewing this on the radio.
Well, that's great.
That's the one thing that we don't have. We've had, my wife has done some basket making, and we've had a few other people doing it, but most of the people don't do basket work. We do twining, which is taking cordage and making containers and bags out of it. Not too much ash baskets.
Well, got an extra hammer, my man. Come on by.
After my blacksmithing, I don't know.
Sounds like you try a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to learn this stuff over the years. Again, one of the neat things with living history is that if you can't afford it, you have to learn how to make it. When you go to one of these living history events, you're required to look and try to act and dress and bring the accoutrements of that particular time period that you're doing. And then, besides that, you generally stay there and you live it for the weekend or a week, whatever, you know, how long the event is. So we've been doing stuff now from, let's see, I've been involved with living history events from almost pre-contact, 1609, right up to basically the 1850s as an Abenaki person portraying his ancestors. Each person has a different time period that they prefer doing. It's a neat thing to kind of be there at night, have a fire going, very few modern intrusions. Sitting there and, you know, people getting together in the dark, you know, around the fire, singing and dancing, cooking over the open fires and stuff like that. Kind of helps you kind of bring the history and the culture back.
Well, I think it's really wonderful that you do that, and together as a tribe, too. It's really fun and everybody's learning. You also talked a little bit about how in your work to gather up the genealogy, you talked a little bit about your family. And in the past, how people didn't really want to say they were Abenaki. They said that they were French. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's in when you go back a ways, this is one of the things that's hurting a lot of people today with the genealogy stuff, is that most of us go back to French Canada, because you got to remember, most of Vermont, you know, before the French and Indian War, was under French control. A lot of Indian children were adopted by French families. A lot of Native people were marrying French people. You know, in this case, mostly it was women marrying French men, because they had very few women who came over here. And one of the things they seem to do, I call it, it's, I don't know if it's a PC way of saying it, but I call it whiterizing. Basically, on paper, making everybody seem as though they are white, that they're not Native. I mean, there was a time, actually, when the Bishop of France actually said that, you know, everybody who's in the colony is, who's a Catholic, is now French. And so you went down on paper like that. That's one of the problems we have down here in the States with the genealogy stuff, is that when people were born, you didn't get to put down what your race was. The person who was at the hospital, he put down, or she put down, your race as whatever they thought you were. Again, you know, we've been intermixing with Europeans for close to 500 years. So a lot of us look white. We don't have the stereotypical Indian look. A good example of that would be my buddy Norman Sadaquis, who's a member of Odenak, or St. Francis in Quebec, but he's also a member of El New down here in the States. His family used to come down from Canada and go down to Rhode Island, and they would sell their baskets down by the sea resorts down there. And his grandfather was born in Rhode Island, and he's put down as white on his birth certificate. So is Norm, because he was born down in Connecticut, and his brother Ronnie, too. If you were on the reservation up in Canada, you would have been put down probably as Indian, because the people up there knew who you were.
La Sauvage.
Yes.
Tell the truth.
Yes. And, you know, and like he said to me, he said, when you're selling your baskets, you want them to know you're Indian, you know, and you dress up in some of your Indian clothing and stuff like that. But he said, you know, when you're traveling around on the regular street up, you know, anywhere, you didn't want people to know who you were, because it just caused problems. I mean, that's the same thing that happened even in my family. My Aunt Dolly, who lived with my great-grandparents, you know, she was told she was Indian, they were Indian, but when she mentioned it in front of guests that she didn't know that well, her dad smacked her right in the face and knocked her on the couch and said, hey, don't you ever tell people that, because, you know, people you don't know get you in trouble. So, wow. You know, so people kind of kept it, you know, on the quiet side and stuff.
Right. Jesse, could you comment a little bit about...
Yeah, if you'd like me to.
Calling your baskets Abnaki made.
Yep. Well, I want to tell this little story first, is okay. That even people within the Northeast Kingdom, you know, they make fun of, you know, Native people and all that, even though they know them and love them. And a good example would be a business owner I know came out of his shop and saw me in the parking lot. And there was all these people out in the shop parking lot. And he comes out and holds his hand over his mouth and goes, like that, to me, directed towards me, and all these people were looking at me and looking at him, and I love the guy. So I just said, I don't have time to burn your store down right now, but call me later. We'll schedule it in, okay? Good to see you again. And everybody was laughing. So was he. But, I mean, you got to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
We do love our neighbors, and of course they have every right to have fun with us. And the same deal when the people always say, why do the Indians always say how? I said, well, that's when the white man first got here, they were always asking the Indians, hey, how'd you do that? How'd you do that? So that's where the word how came from. When they raised their hand, they were interrupting. How did you do that? But just a little bit of humor. Roger knows
okay.
How it is.
All right.
I got to remember those stories.
Yeah, it's all true, too. You heard it here first.